Thanks, Ros. I'm Mary. I'm an addict. And I'm really pleased to be here tonight. I was just talking to Frank, and we were talking about the convention and kind of convention chairs and everything. And I really enjoy conventions. I'm not a shy person. I don't have a problem with crowds. And I fully appreciate that there are people who do, and, you know, that whose idea of hell is to come to something like this. And a convention is just really beyond them. And that's never been... That's really not my problem at all. You know, and I really love them. I really love all of us getting together to celebrate the fact that, you know, hopeless cases like us not only stop using, but we turn our lives around, and we become sort of that ghastly phrase, productive members of society. Plus, you know, and we help each other, and we pass this on. And I think I'm very lucky. I remain relentlessly inspired by NA. I find it new and exciting. That's because it always is. There's always new people coming in, and, you know, my friends' lives change and my life changes, and it is. And I feel very blessed for that. I do think I play a part in it. You know, I come back, and I work a program, and I do service, and I stay clean a day at a time. And it wasn't always like that. But today, and for quite an extended period of time now, it has been. And, you know, my life, for the most part, is absolutely wonderful. It has its problems. But I experience a freedom today on a pretty much daily basis that I never imagined was possible. And I'm not just talking about freedom from active addiction, which is all this program promises us, but I experience freedom from self, which is just wonderful. You know, I lived with me like this for so many fucking years. And, you know, in my head, I'm pretty wonderful. But I know the reality is I'm not that wonderful. And I'm just not that fucking interesting. And it, you know, so to be free from Mary is just such a joy, because it means that I'm free to be a part of a world that for so many years I found absolutely terrifying and confusing. And for a long time, I really didn't want to be a part of it in the way that kind of regular people are. And I'm a nice girl from Hertfordshire. still. In my dad's eyes, he wishes. And he knows I'm not, but we all pretend. And I've got a mum and a dad and two sisters, and I'm really lucky. I love them, and they love me. And it was quite messy. My family, like everybody's, it's terribly Middle England. But there is a lot of love there, and it's not me, but I do think my recovery and the fact that most members of my family are kind of bright and willing people, you know, we've really grown together. I've just come back from a skiing holiday in Switzerland. It's a thank you daddy holiday. And we're in this fabulous hotel, really outdoor hot tub, private guides. All I have to do is pay my airfare, 13 of us, 13 people. I live on my own. I work for myself. So 13 members of my family. We have my sister, my middle sister Emma, her husband John, the two children, Jess and all, 13 and 11. And then my younger sister Jo and her boyfriend, Joe's two kids, Ian's two kids, mum and dad, and me. And it's intense. You know, it's fabulous. And it's like being in this kind of snow and family bubble in the Swiss Alps. And I, you know, recovery, I've learned a lot in recovery. I know my optimum with my family is a week. Any more than a week, and we have a terrible fight. And I pick a huge fight with someone, and it all ends in terrible tears. And, you know, self-esteem that I've built up around my family, relationships that I've built up around with my family that have taken years of painful progress are destroyed overnight. So, I left after a week, and I came back. And I kind of sat catatonic on my sofa for 24 hours. And but, you know, the fact that, you know, that I can do that, and that, you know, that whole, I didn't think about using. I didn't have to be the centre of attention. I didn't shag the ski guide or the concierge. You know, I didn't embarrass or humiliate myself or anybody else. You know, I just, I mean, you know, when I was drinking that, I bought the whole bar drinks. I used to get smashed, and my dad, you know, we're talking the 1970s here, had a bar bill of $6,000. You know, I mean, I was an expensive daughter. And, you know, so, you know, we're looking at progress here. And it just is. And there was one night, my dad, you know, he's the one I've had the problems in my recovery with. And, you know, he's a working class northern bloke made good. And we are never going to sit down and have this I love you, darling conversation. He did do that once to me, and I nearly fell on the floor. But, you know, he does love me, and he loves my sister, and he just shows it in different ways. I never, ever, ever have an NA-type conversation with him, ever. And he does not like talk about my past. I mean, it appalled him. You know, I'm the eldest of three. I was very clever. I had scholarships at school. I was the girl most likely to, and I got nicked for prostitution. And he was horrified, you know. I mean, I have a real appreciation of how that must have hurt him today. And I can laugh about it here, but it's the one place we don't go. And if I want to get my inheritance. And
go on, Mary.
Yes.
Go on, girl.
And we were sitting at dinner, and a conversation came up about you know, about someone who I used to use with or something, and I kind of went there a bit, and he just went, oh God, we don't have to talk about that. And I was decimated, you know. I just went to that place of kind of little child Mary, and oh, hurt and rejected, and oh God, I'm awful. And I just didn't make a big deal about it, you know. My part in that is that I know this today, and I went there, and I'm in recovery, not him. I spent a long time in recovery waiting for my dad to say sorry to me. He doesn't need to. This is about me. The only person I can do anything about is me. So I went back upstairs. I actually rang my pool sponsor in London. And, you know, and I chatted it through with her. And the other great thing was, you know, I look at my past and I just let it go. And I woke up the next morning and I was able to swing on in with the holiday. And just, you know, kind of go there and just be a part of it, you know, turn up and do it. And they love it. You know, my dad, we were age range 7 to 75 on the ski slopes. My parents, 72 and 75, and they ski 6 or 7 hours a day. They're incredibly active. It bodes well. You know, I hope I'm like them one day. They are, you know, they have their moments. And like I said, a week only. And I come home, but, you know, I am so grateful that I can do things like that today. But I'm also incredibly grateful that I know my limitations. I know how to look after myself. I have a daily program that I work that enables me to do this stuff. And then, you know, and I come home and, you know, and I get on and I do my life. And, you know, and it's been a fantastic journey to get to this place. You know, in June this year, I will have been a member of Narcotics Anonymous for 26 years. But I'm not, no, but I'm not 26 years clean. I'm in my 17th year of recovery. But I came to, you know, I wish. I used to sulk at conventions. But happily, you know, I think I'd be the most clean person here. But I've moved on. I have moved on. Thank fuck for that. And, you know, it's, dear God. I came to Narcotics Anonymous in 1981 when I was 21 years old. And NA had been going 10 months in this country. I like powders in syringes, but basically I'll take anything. And I was a dreadful slag when I was drunk. And the worst driver in the world, bar none. And and a very, very mad drug addict. I was, you know, just really chaotic and, you know, and it was always, and I'd do sort of mad things and I'd end up, you know, like I ended up in rehab in Minneapolis and I walked out because I wanted to go to Prince's nightclub, First Avenue, in January. And there's 3 meters of snow on the ground. I also heard that the drug area was around there. And I didn't know anyone in Minneapolis. So from the rehab, they dropped me at the airport and I left my suitcase. And I trotted off down to First Avenue. I ended up about 100 miles outside Minneapolis with these guys saying, give us a blowjob and we'll give you some crack. And I suddenly came to and I just thought, oh my God, you know, I could die and they could throw me in a snowdrift and they wouldn't find me for 4 months and no one would know. And somehow, I got out of there and came back to Brighton and joined an escort agency. I'd never been to Brighton before. But anyway, there we go. I was just kind of like that. And that kind of real reactive thinking, when you're on drugs and you have an idea, it's just like, oh, I'll go and do it. And, and today I may have those ideas, but I don't go and do them. At least I think about it, have a chat with a friend, pray, do a little bit of yoga, and then think, maybe not. And, under the influence of, a 4 months on Largactyl on a section, followed by the shoot coke diet, very effective for losing weight, not so good for the brain cells. My ability to make a rational decision was not great. And so, anyway. So I ended up, so I was a fairly chaotic kind of user. And but by the time I was 21, I realized that I couldn't stay stopped from drugs. I'd, done the things that we, gone to different countries and even tried getting a job once, but that was just awful. And, I'm still not the world's biggest work enthusiast, it has to be said. And if someone said to me, Mary, you can never work again, I'd be like, okay. I can live with that. I think it really was act of God. I was incredibly lucky because there was one meeting in the whole country then. NA had been going 10 months. And I ended up at this really smart doctor's surgery in Knightsbridge. And I was a kind of, Kings Road quasi-punk junkie, but I lived in my parents' house flat in Pimlico and I drove a BMW because I didn't really want to do it properly and I didn't like sleeping rough. And so, it was all a bit of a sham, the whole thing. And I ended up at this... And I had this very nice boyfriend, actually. He loved me. He was the one that got away. Anyway, but I tried to kill him because he wouldn't give me any drugs. And at that point, I thought, I'm in trouble. I'm really in trouble. Never mind the lying, cheating, stealing. I can live with all of that. Fuck everybody else off, but not the boyfriend, because he was quite nice. And I ended up at this doctor's surgery, which was the one doctor's surgery in London that knew about 12-step recovery for addicts. And Christopher, bless him, who's still my doctor, got Giles R, who's still clean today, to come and 12-step me. And I remember sitting there thinking, God. And Giles has got a fairly full-on story. And I was like, eyes on poles, chin on the floor. I thought, God, how awful. I never did anything like that. But it stuck in my mind, and he was the first person, because, it was all that stuff of everybody stopping talking about, everyone talk, nothing changes. And he was the first person, he kind of had a job and a suit, and he obviously was not using drugs, and he was pretty bonkers, but, he wasn't using. And about 5 days later, I went into the treatment centre, and, at the convention last weekend, I was sitting there and I looked over the room and there was a man there. I met him at school when I was 16. He was the first junkie I met. When I started to shoot drugs, I sought him out and got him to teach me to fix. We got busted together and he was in treatment with me, and I have not seen him for about 16 years or something, and he was at the convention. He's still clean, and it absolutely made my convention. I was practically in tears. I was really, really touched to see him. You know, he's a big part of my story, and I'm really glad to see that he's all right and that, you know, he's come back to meetings, because I can't imagine doing this on my own without the fellowship. It, you know, I do love this. And I ended up in this treatment center, and I intellectually I embraced complete abstinence. I never had a problem with that. I knew I was awful when I drank. I really, you know, I took hard drugs because I couldn't bear myself drinking anymore. And I completely accept that, you know, the drugs that I haven't taken, I would have a problem with today. You know, I never had a problem with that at all. But like I said, there was only one NA meeting in the country, and so, you know, after your period of time or whatever, you get taken to a 12-step meeting, and it was AA, and you know, AA in Western Supermare on a Tuesday night or something, and it was, God, and it was, I mean, apologies to people who've heard this, but it was, you know, cracked grey cups and tea with powdered milk and kind of 2 70-year-old blokes at the front. And I just thought, what the fuck happened? You know? This is just awful. You know, this is my life. And I was appalled. I was absolutely appalled. And then I had to stay, and my first ever job was in a cleaner in an old people's home, and you'd sort of find false teeth and things. And I was just like, I'm really not sure about this straight life. I mean, it just was very... couldn't say anything though. 22 years old, 21 years old, couldn't say anything. But I mean, I just was eyes on poles, and I didn't know where else to go, because I, you know. And so anyway, because there was a gang of us there, whose drug of choice was something other than alcohol, we decided we'd start an NA meeting. So, you know, we got the 5 pamphlets and the little white book, which was all the literature that NA literature that existed in those days. There was no basic text or anything that hadn't even been written. And we got Dudley and David B and Giles came down from London, and we had this NA meeting on a Sunday night. And I was the tea person. I was gutted because I wanted to be the secretary, but my friend, who I was very jealous of, but I never told anyone, became the secretary. And, you know, the honesty bit hadn't got very far at that point. And but anyway, we had this meeting, and as soon as I heard our readings, something shifted, because we talk about the disease of addiction, and you know, bless them, I have no problems with other fellowships, and we owe our existence to them, but you know, we are not affiliated, and you know, our literature is written for me and you. You know, it's about addiction, and I'm an addict, and there are some fundamental differences, and you know, I don't need to dwell on those, but you know, I fell in love with NA, and I was incredibly proud to be a member, and I got what I wanted. I got respect, and actually sort of veneration, not putting too fine a point on it, because if you know, there was me and my friend, and she was blonde with big tits, and I was, you know, sort of brunette and kind of long and lean, and if you wanted to do the family thing, she was your sponsor, and if you wanted to be the career girl, I was your sponsor, and we kind of carved up the fellowship between us, really. And my group of friends and I, we got the service structure going. We all decided what jobs we wanted to do before the meeting, so we just voted ourselves in on the jobs that we pre-decided that we wanted to do anyway. So it was all very democratic. And I was H&I with Crowbar Johnny, and and he was one of the co-founders of NA, and he was sort of from Essex and had a list of criminal convictions as long as your arm. And I was from Hertfordshire. I never went into a prison until I came into the fellowship. And so he did the prisons, and he knew all the prison governors by name. And, you know, a lot of the H&I is down to him. You know, the fact that he got us into so many prisons, he really did, because he knew them all. And they could not believe it with him. They could not believe it, how it had changed his life around. And I used to do kind of most of the treatments, H&I meetings in treatment centres and things. And I had a job as a secretary in St James's Square. I walked past the building I used to work in. And I was the world's worst secretary. I was absolutely awful. I spent all the time on the phone to my friends, sorting out chairs for the institutions. And if these poor people ever asked me to do any work, I'd be like, but I'm busy. And, it was just my sister covered for me. She was on break from university. She covered for me while I went on holiday one year, and they asked if she'd stay on because I was that awful. I was not destined. And recovery then was kind of, I thought recovery then meant you had to be really straight. So I sort of became this twin set and pearl secretary, which is really not me. I was really hard work to be around, and but incredibly willing. And, I wouldn't swap. I'm really glad I had those 5 years, but I really missed the point of being in the fellowship. And I never learnt to say I don't know. I never learnt to say please help me. I never learnt to share my feelings honestly, and I didn't work the steps. And eventually it all went horribly tits up, and I went off to Australia to write a fourth step and find out if I was bisexual, which I never told anyone either. I just went, and I don't know what I was thinking, and well, I do, but anyway, and and I just had this catastrophic nervous breakdown. I had a really bad nervous breakdown, and I came back to the UK, and I got sectioned and everything, and I wouldn't take medication because I said, I'm in NA and I can't take medication, and then I used, and I was appalled because, in NA, I kind of had a dignity that I'd never had before. And when I lost that, I was devastated. So I thought, well, if I can't be a princess in NA, I'm not going to be in NA at all. So I kind of ran around, became a hooker, did all sorts of things, and then ran off to Cornwall and lived there for 3 years and just went completely crazy. And I lived with this disease like this, with Mary in all her utter horror for 4 years. And it was awful and it was so painful. And, I know there are many people in this room who, like me, who've relapsed, and it's just awful trying to, use when you know you don't have to. And when there's another way, and I'd sort of be ripping someone off and trying to 12-step them. And everything gets really, really confused. And I would sit in my house in Cornwall and I think, well, I can't get clean again because my 8th step will be too long. So I nearly became a Jehovah's Witness because they said that the world was going to end soon and 144,000 people would be saved. And I thought, well, all the good people will be saved, so I don't have to do anything, so I'll become a witness. And then when the world ends, I'll say sorry when we're all in heaven together. And it was all very, 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 very confusing. Left to my, my brain full of drugs without a program is a very, very scary place to be. And, it got very, very messy down there. And I lost a lot of brain cells and nearly lost my life. And I came, and I was so ashamed of myself, and I thought, I can never come back to NA. But I'll be rejected here. I really had missed the point. And I ended up in treatment and I got slung out. And I knew the UK convention was on in Bristol. So I got on a train, picked up a man, got drunk, got him to take me to Bristol, dragged him off to St Paul's to score some drugs, ran off with someone else, went back to the hotel and got this poor man to drop me at the UK convention, which was my return to NA after 3 years. I was like this. And the first person I saw was Giles, and then a girl I'd been at school with, and who I hated. And had a resentment for over 20 years. Have let go now. Finally, no resentment. And some hang around, don't they? They just hang around. And but we have moved on. And people were really kind to me. And three men who I don't really know, and with really pure motives, which is quite strange. Bless you all. Actually, I love men. And they swept me up, and they took me back to London, and I went to meetings again, and people were really kind to me. And I couldn't hack it, and I ran off back down to Cornwall, and I nearly died shooting speed, training to be a lifeguard. And then... And somehow I ended up back here, and in meetings. Yeah, you wouldn't want to be my parents, would you? And and they paid for it all too. And I ended up back at this doctor's surgery, the man who got me in, and I went there to hit him up for some pills. And I was at that stage, you know, where all I could think about was, you know, £20 meant a bag. I was just in that drugs tunnel where my world had just gone like this. And I was kind of in hostels on the, in Earl's Court, and hotels if I slept with someone. And, you know, it was awful. And And anyway, I ended up back in treatment, and on October the 17th, 1990, it was my first day off detox, and I haven't used since then. And I went to an NA meeting that night, and I've been clean ever since. You know, and it's and. And I'm a bit tired and emotional tonight because I've just been going to too many football matches. I mean, I do find it quite moving, LA as well. But I have been tramping up and down the bloody motorway watching Manchester United, which is worth it at the moment. Yeah, what have they got to play for? Don't. I'm not in the mood. And so, you know, I like, but I'm going back tomorrow as well. That is my a healthy outlet for this obsessive person. And it has been kind of all my recovery, and I love it. I've been a fan since I was about six, and you know, now I get to go. I've got a book and everything, and it's fantastic. And when I was in treatment then, I would have been content to stay there and just sweep the leaves off the drive if it meant I didn't end up in a mental hospital or in jail. And I had no concept of where this program, where plugged into this fellowship and no longer powerless, where as an empowered recovering addict, I can go. And it, you know, the biggest difference is the steps. For me, this was the one thing I knew I had to do. I knew to come to meetings, I knew to do service. I had to learn to share honestly, but I kind of knew to do that stuff. But I, in my soul, I knew that if I didn't work the steps, that I would, you know, that where I was, you know, that I would go back out again. And I just knew on some level that I couldn't do that again. I really could not use again. It wasn't so much that I would overdose and die, but it was that I hated myself so much. I was so frightened, and it was this really, really violent self-hatred. I mean, I treated myself like an animal, and there was a part of me that very strongly believed I didn't deserve to live, and it was a real battle to stay on top of that. And I used to think about killing myself all the time, and you know, I knew that, you know, up to a point, coming to meetings and hanging out and staying, you know, staying clean and getting a job and doing that stuff works, but there needed to be a really fundamental shift within me to stay here. And so, you know, the last 16 years, I've had a sponsor and I've worked the steps. Not with enormous vigor, it has to be said. You know, please don't, I'm not, you know, 12 steps a year person at all. But I have always known which step I'm working, and I've pretty much, you know, bar the odd few months between sponsors, I've had a sponsor, and I sponsor quite a lot of people as well. I love sponsorship, and I have a few health problems, which sometimes means that, you know, for me to kind of do committee service and stuff is hard for me, but I can sponsor, you know, I can be on the end of a phone, or, you know, you can come round to my house or whatever, and I can brrr at you, or you can brrr at me, and... you know, we can do that sponsor stuff. And, you know, and I've been really blessed. You know, I've had some great sponsors. And it is the single thing that I've done differently this time that has changed my recovery and changed my life. And, you know, on a very, you know, the first three steps got me into the fellowship. My concept of powerlessness and insanity and letting go kind of shifts all the time, and it grows and expands. But fundamentally, I know that I am, on my own, I'm powerless, and that I can't do it on my own, and that there is a power greater than myself. And for a long time, it was just this fellowship and the people in it. And, you know, now I've expanded that, and that's fine. It doesn't matter. All we say is that it be loving and greater than you. That's all you have to believe. And, you know, and I needed it simple. I was fried. I'd done a lot of speed, and I was sort of one brain cell Mary. I mean, I was gone. And, you know, fourth steps, I've done a few over the years. They freed me when I did one that it really was a kind of harms thing that I did. And, you know, the first, the big one of all the shitty things I did. And after I'd read my step five, and I did that thing, there was one really shitty thing that I'd done that I didn't share with her, and I knew I had to. I rang her the next day, and we met up. I rang her that night, and we met her the next day and shared it with her then. But that step four and five was really so key for me. I started to live free of the past. I started to stop dragging, as James described, that sack load of shame around. I started to be able to offload a bit of it. And I think for me, it is a constant process. I've just done another very different step four, and I've shifted a load of shame that I really didn't know. Come back to that. And anyway, six and seven, bashed my head against the wall. I also think that, you know, sharing all that stuff with one other member of this fellowship, not a professional, not someone who on the internet or lives wherever, you know, someone who I was going to see again, was incredibly powerful for me. That they, you know, that, you know, she didn't reject me, you know. And it's, I mean, I, you know, I have to say, having heard quite a few step fives, well, it's never entered my head to reject anybody, you know. And I did this one thing that I was really ashamed of, and it's funny, a sponsee who I did her step five, she shared exactly the same thing with me. You know, it just, if I stay connected and I keep doing this stuff, you know, I get the healing. And six and seven, didn't understand, was a bit willing occasionally to have the odd defect that was bothering me today removed, but never entirely willing to have God remove all. Never mind humbly ask. So took time, definitely a process, not an event, and an ongoing one, because it is an aim for perfection. Six and seven, you know, this program is about an aim for perfection, and we're human, we're never going to be perfect. So it's, but the willingness is, my passing is that I'm willing to start today, you know, and to continue to work, you know, kind of towards that. And it's different to perfectionism. But it's just a recognition that this is an ongoing journey for me, that, you know, that I'm always, you know, I'm never there. This is it today, right here, right now, this is it. And, you know, and kind of that's my part. And eight and nine, I wasn't willing. I thought, my dad's so much money, he's quite rich, and I can't pay him back, so well, that's that. Leave it. And and I was willing to make amends to all the people I lied and deceived and wrecked their homes, or, well, you know, all the other stuff I did. And I suddenly realised, you know, it's made a list, and, you know, the financial ones I did separately, you know, as a, you know, family, friends, lovers, financial, it's become willing, you know. It doesn't say I have to do it, you know. I missed a lot of it, took me a long, you know, it really, blame the speed. And and then nine, made direct amends, except when to do so, but injure them or others. And, you know, and the others bit comes into me. I don't put myself on my amends list. Everybody does it differently, though. It really doesn't matter. This is just what I do. You know, I didn't put myself on it because my whole recovery is an amend to me. You know, this, you know, I do it on a daily basis. I make amends to myself, but I do the injure them or others. You know, I come on the others bit. I don't believe I need to put myself in, kind of in a real mess. And then 10, 11, and 12, the maintenance programs. You know, I'm quite a sort of high energy atom person, and it was a lot of the time a human doing. And in 1998, just before the World Cup, that's how I remember it. It's all around a football match, and I had a breakdown again. And I have this predisposition. I ended up in a nut house, and okay, it was a nice one, but it's nevertheless a nut house, and it was bloody frightening. And I'd taken up yoga beforehand, and when I came out of, you know, I was so frightened I was going to use again. When I came out of this place, yeah, I stopped my life, and I went to meetings every day. And although what was wrong with me wasn't around my recovery, coming to meetings every day held me. And you know, there were some people in who couldn't deal with me being a bit nuts, and there were other people who I didn't expect really reached out to me. And you know, kind of that's the way it is. You know, there's always someone who's there for you. And I came out of it, and my instinct was to kind of go with yoga. And I ended up becoming a yoga teacher. And which you obviously all guessed. And can you imagine what I was like without it? Yeah, this is nine years, 4 hours yoga a day. You know, I'm very, very calm and centered compared to what I was like. And you know, and they're either kind of breakdowns or breakthroughs. You know, and you know, staying clean, it became a breakthrough, and you know, my life changed, and I learned. I never understood when people talked about peace of mind. I think, what the fuck's that about? You know, it's all about running around and having a good time, and you know, not that kind of selfish having a good time, but being in life. And I suddenly understood. So that quiet time I take for myself most mornings. I'm not nailed into it, but I do it 5 or 6 mornings a week. I take, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour quiet time to start my day, and it's really valuable. It does set me up to do my life. And you know, and it was like the missing link. You know, for me it was that kind of brought it all together. And then 12. You know, it is the sort of the great paradox of, you know, we keep what we have only by giving it away. And so I get to recycle all this stuff that led me to want to kill myself, and suddenly it becomes valuable information in helping someone else. And and it's just extraordinary. I find it this is without, you know, no contest, this is the best thing I've ever done in my life. You know, everything else that I have and everything else that I do, the person that I am today, everything is because of this. You know, I was, you know, a wreck of a human being, and now I'm not. And you know, I just have, you know, I am a sister and a friend and a daughter and a sponsor and a lover sometimes, quite a good one. And I say so myself. And that definitely gets better in recovery. And just knowing who they are, you know. It's a start, isn't it? It's a start. You know. So, you know, it is, you know, it's great coming to this meeting and doing this chair because, you know, I've been in the recovery a long, long time. And, you know, yes, any chair is a privilege to do, but to get this kind of 40 minutes, to be able to kind of just expand it a little bit. So, you know, thank you for asking me, Roz, and thank you for listening to me.